All right. Alan Butler from the Liberty Express just sent me a text message. What's wrong? Well, Alan, I can't text back to you because I'm on the air right now. But the answer is, I'm an idiot. In fact, I think I should pull up the soundbite of the old man saying, I'm an idiot. Because, well, you know, it's fitting. Hey. Leave it to iTunes to screw me on my soundbite. Oh, well. I'm an idiot. I'm sorry, man. I don't know. The mic, it's in my way, so I keep it out of the way. But I have to unplug the mic from the cable to get it out of my way. And I moved it back into my way, but I forgot to plug it back in. So, I was sitting here talking to myself, thinking that, well, everybody can hear me, of course, because the light's on and the lights are on. How much dead air was that? Like 45 seconds? Don't tell me it was more than that. It probably was, just since I think it wasn't. Oh, well. You know, here's the thing about live radio. There's going to be screw-ups all the time. So what? Who cares, right? Good. All right. What I was saying was, on the show today, Phil Giraldi, Jason Leopold, Gareth Porter. Now, you might think, gee whiz, Scott, we already heard you interview Phil Giraldi and Jason Leopold and Gareth Porter. But here's the thing about that. I don't go by the person. I go by the subject matter. I go by the article that they wrote. And all three of these guys have killer pieces today. Now, Phil Giraldi is blowing the lid off of how they almost lied us into war in Syria and what was going on behind the scenes there at the CIA. You're going to want to know about that. You know, for the historical record. And Jason Leopold has got his hands on all of Abu Zubaydah's journals going back to the early 1990s. 6 volumes. Very interesting stuff. And Gareth Porter, of course, is Gareth Porter. And he has now published his analysis of what happened last weekend. Which means I want to hear him say it out loud. You know what it is? Here's what the show's about, in case you're just catching on, you know. I'm trying to get you to want to read Gareth Porter all the time. That's all, really. That's what I want out of life, is to see everybody else getting Gareth Porter articles read. That's what I want. And I think that's not asking too much. And I think if I could get everybody to agree that, you know what, Scott Horton, you're right, we should read Gareth Porter all the time, then I would live in a much less violent world. Because face it, the supermajority of all violence on Earth is carried out by the U.S. government. Okay, maybe that's not true. Maybe it's drunken husbands. Second place, America. So, it seems like if people knew the truth about what their government was doing and how every time that they say that they have a reason to do the horrible things that they do, that it ain't right, why then, maybe people wouldn't let them get away with doing so many horrible things all the time. That's my philosophy of life. Read Gareth Porter. So here he is explaining, and you know, it's not always investigative stuff debunking a war party lie, but it's always an extremely valuable perspective when it's, for example, an analysis piece like this, and he does have original sources in here too. But that's what's good about him, too, is he's one of them kinds of journalists that you're supposed to hate, like Glenn Greenwald, who doesn't pretend that he doesn't have a point of view. Of course he has a point of view. Why would any reporter pick any topic to cover other than their point of view? Scott Peterson over at the Christian Science Monitor, I know for a fact that his opinion is that it's worth paying attention to the details of America's Iran policy and reporting on them. So, how biased is he And we can tell it's written all over his face. He wears it right on his sleeve that he's so biased about what he thinks is important in the world, he's chosen the Iran beat in the first place. All report, and I'm not accusing him of being a critic of the Green Wall. I didn't mean to say it, imply that. But you hear all these denunciations from all these supposed straight news reporters talking about how, well, what they do is different and better and more professional than what Greenwald does, when, of course, he's kicking the combined ass of almost the entire population of America's press corps in 1 year's time, never mind all the great opinion writing he did before that and the Bradley Manning torture story that he broke and a couple others before the Snowden revelations. But, well, you look at David Sanger at the New York Times. He covers the Iran beat, and his opinion is that Iran is hell-bent on making nuclear weapons and that they must be stopped by America before Iran hurts Israel. That's what he thinks. We all know he thinks that. I think it's even possible he really thinks that and isn't just pretending to think that, like most people who claim to think that. It's ridiculous as it is. All these straight news reporters. Yeah, right. Well, here's Gareth Porter. He clearly is hell-bent on getting to the truth of all the things that our government says are the reasons why they have to do the horrible things that they do in their foreign policy. And he's been great on Iraq and great on Afghanistan. Award-winning work on the surge, Obama's surge in Afghanistan. And virtually all the wars. He's just written a brand new book about Iran. Anyway, I'm just going on and on. Gareth Porter, he's a great guy. He's a hell of a great reporter. And he's going to be on and he's going to tell us what he thinks about what happened last weekend, why it did, and what it all means. And from reading his piece just now before the show, in fact, I still have two or three paragraphs left, it doesn't sound much different than what we heard from Flint Leverett yesterday as well, about there being enough blame to go around and who did what. But anyway, extremely important stuff. So there you go. Long intro to the show today, but god dang, I just like talking about how good Gareth Porter's journalism is sometimes. And for that matter, Giraldi and Leopold, too. Both of them got extremely important stories as well today. All right. So now let me talk about the Philippines for just a second. I heard a radio show today on NPR News, and I don't know what it was. And if there was a host of it, you know, stateside explaining what's going on, I never heard that part. All I heard was Filipinos, I believe they were in the Philippines, with access to PRI or whatever kind of public radio syndicate. And they were begging and screaming for help on behalf of others, but the typhoon just, I don't know how many, they said they estimated 10,000 dead off the bat. I don't know if it was really that high or maybe worse. It's certainly possible, I guess. I hadn't heard the latest estimate of the numbers, but it's certainly true that there are a lot of people without clean drinking water and food to eat and shelter at night, and that's got to be solved immediately. No matter how many people already die, there are a lot more people in danger of dying. Imagine your young family members getting cholera or something, and there's no doctors, there's no... All the channels of distribution that normally operate are all broken down and nothing is working. And these people need help. And it reminded me that, and I hope I don't sound too much like a right winger in this way, because I think if you're a hippie, hear me out and you'll sort of agree with me, that man's greatest nature, I can't even say it right, so don't worry about it. Man's greatest enemy, other than, you know, himself, each other, Mother Nature. And I don't mean that as, to try to justify, you know, man ought to wage war against all nature and pave the planet over and turn it into Cybertron or something like that. Turn the whole world into Dallas, 200 square miles of ugly-ass concrete. No, it's not that. I just mean volcanoes and earthquakes and typhoons and tidal waves and things like that. Well, and you know, also the summer sun and the winter cold, for that matter. Blizzards and heat strokes and things like that, real high temperatures, those can all be very deadly too. But so it just seemed to me that if we could, and I know this sounds fanciful to a lot of ears, but it actually, and I'm not a utopian type, I think you probably are well aware, but I do think it is within the realm of possibility to mostly abolish war. It just isn't really beneficial for even the victors in almost all cases, and, you know, you can't talk all groups out of their own perceived self-interest at all times, but virtually everywhere in the world, slavery is outlawed. It still goes on, but it's universally condemned and almost universally outlawed, and that is impossible if you look at the history of mankind. Think how crazy that is, that that was ever accomplished. How magnificent that is, that that was ever accomplished. It's the same kind of thing with war. Could be done. And then, wouldn't it be cool if instead of having, and I guess, you know, people like Robert Higgs was saying in his great essay the other day at The Independent about the evils of nationalism, about how people, whether it's a lack of religion or this, that, or the other thing, people just have a hole in their heart and they gotta believe in something. They just gotta believe in something. And so it seems to me like you don't have to be a complete Bill Hicksian utopian where something like heaven might dawn or any of that. Just, hey, what if our organizing principle was making sure we were ready to where if a typhoon ever came and killed 10,000 people, that we would be like blam with our armada of medicine and drinking water. And I don't mean that as that would be a great justification for the U.S. Navy. I mean, that would be a great replacement for the U.S. Navy. We don't need the U.S. Navy. Just let private people. And by the way, these desperate people, and look, the desperation, the voices of the people I was listening to, it was their heart going out to their, I believe they were Filipinos too. I'm not certain exactly who they were. But they were crying out for the pain of these people. And there was certainly no ideology at play. I mean, we're talking about public radio, and most people who ain't rich in the world, all lean, hard left, whatever. There was no libertarian ideology at play here. But the entire conversation was really about how whoever can hear us, please come help. And whatever you do, don't give your aid, your money, or your supplies to the government. Just bring them to the people who need them, they cried. And they started listing the towns and the sides of towns that are hardest hit and most in desperate need. And they're saying, whoever can hear me in the world, please come and go to North Cebu City as fast as you can. And whatever you do, don't give your supplies or your aid money or anything to the government. They will just keep it, devour it themselves. They could have said, don't ask your governments to come and help us either. Just you. You know? Calling all private vessels that have an extra water supply that they could spare. Somewhere in the Pacific Ocean. The Filipinos need your help. And it was interesting listening to him crying on about the one woman. She was almost hysterical to the point where it was undermining her case, which there's a lesson for me in there, where she was saying, you know, what in the hell do you mean you have to coordinate? Just load the stuff on the plane and then push it out the back door, you know? Now, obviously, that's a little bit oversimplified, but not quite that much. And she was, you know, at the end of her wits, man. It's been days and days and days of this. People are, you can't go that long without water, without falling down dead, people. You know? So, she had real complaints. And it reminded me, obviously, of what happened at Katrina. And this happens to various degrees in other places. Katrina was very unique, of course, because New Orleans is below sea level. So it's not like they just got flooded. They got flooded and the water stayed and had to be pumped out over a long period of time. And it was a terrible thing times 10 or to the 10th power or whatever. But remember that those evil, greedy, selfish capitalist pigs, the Waltons, sent their fleet of 18-wheelers, like I think all of them, and said, hey, everybody, your stores are stocked enough for now. Hey, 18-wheeler drivers, load up with bottles of water and head to New Orleans. And I don't know how many that was. I'm exaggerating for sure. But there was an armada of trucks, a caravan of 18-wheelers, of Walmart 18-wheelers trying to bring bottled water to the people in New Orleans, and the government turned them away. Mission one, continuity of government. Mission two, scratch your ass and stand around. Mission three, fight between different branches of government and different levels, local, state, and federal. Mission four, begin to consider the people baking on their rooftops, wallowing in the Superdome. What do you mean rescue people? What do you mean let a Walmart driver risk the jungle of the black part of New Orleans if he's willing to be so brave to try to bring people some water in his 18-wheeler? I bet you can find some big, tough, brave 18-wheeler drivers who aren't so scared of what they heard about cannibalism and mass rapes and looting and violence in the aftermath. You know, like the people in New Orleans are a bunch of others. Sickening. Remember that? How they did that? Same kind of thing in the Philippines right now. Please don't give your aid to the government. Give it to the people. And please hurry. So it just seemed to me like, you know, I don't know. It's like, I'm a libertarian. I don't believe in any social welfare safety net whatsoever. If I could abolish it tomorrow, I'd abolish it tomorrow. It's so bad for poor people to think that the government is there to take care of them. The government is your enemy. You might have done a bunch of time for nothing. You might know what I'm talking about, poor people. They're not here for you. The welfare is the bribe, so you think they're anything but your local kidnapping extortionist racket. They're your enemies. On the other hand, it's not the first thing I want to repeal, it's the last thing. And you look at the total for food stamps worldwide, nationwide, it's like, 50, 60 billion a year or something like that? And I'm probably conflating women, infants, and children and all the other welfare federal welfare programs, the direct transfers, and I don't know, the Medicaid, Medicare budgets, whatever, but that's nothing compared to the money they spend on militarism. They spend $1 trillion a year on militarism. And then they got to make a bunch of cuts to your grandma's Social Security that she paid into all along on the threat that she had to and on the promise that she was going to get it back, that it was more or less her public but still her retirement savings account. That's the thinly defined lie that people believe. You know that, look, you're just not going to save for your retirement, so we're going to make you. But it's your money, and you've got it coming. Now, they're going to cut all that so that the Pentagon can have enough money to mass murder people while Filipinos die of thirst. Sorry, break time. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com. All right. Hey, listen, sorry, Future Freedom Foundation. I just screwed you out of your ad there. Sometimes I don't watch the clock so good. And you know what? I don't know, man. I'm sorry for trying to appeal to your better angels and whatever. I do not believe in the new any kind of man. It just seems to me like we got our priorities so screwed up. You know, I'm from here. I'm a Texan. I'm an American. And there's always been one or the other level of warfare my whole life. The Cold War when I was a kid. And you know, the aftermath of Vietnam, of course. But then ever since ninth grade, there's been war. And it seems like, whatever, well, that's just the way it is. I remember my friend Jimmy told me, oh, you work for antiwar.com, huh? Well, so let me tell you something. There's, which kind of war are you opposing? Religious war or resource war? Because there's always going to be both. So what the hell are you wasting your time for? Of course, he's right about a lot of that. Although I think the religious thing is always just the lipstick on the pig. That's just how they, the army recruiters on all sides, dress up their crime, you know, for the recruits to, you know, give them something to believe in. Everybody take a knee and pray to Jesus before we go out there and massacre people, that kind of thing. But anyway, in almost every country in the world, they're not at war all the time. So, in a way, you think, well, yeah, that's just how, that's the entire history of humanity and whatever. But you know what? Lately, that's the entire history of us. And part of it is because nukes are so scary that no major powers are willing to risk their own capital cities fighting other major powers. And the costs of, you know, old school colonialism are just too great. You know, PR-wise and everything else. It's easier to be like the Chinese and just send in armies of men with briefcases full of cash. It's only the idiot Americans that are stuck in the past, running around waging wars all the time, trying to create this permanent system of unipolar hegemony that, by its very definition, cannot work. You know, George Lucas put it in Star Wars perfectly. The more you tighten your grip, the more systems slip through your fingers. That's easy, right? There's no USSR out there to scare anyone into our camp. There's all the scaring goes one way. People running in terror from us. So what the hell kind of global hegemony is that? When by definition, it's self-defeating. And why should it be that regular Americans just accept that, yeah, this is our purpose in life, basically. Our nation is a big farm where the Pentagon gets its resources and its people to go out on its expeditionary adventures around the world. You know, like they're the French Foreign Legion or something. Well, geez, Scott, it seems like it's been that way for so long in a row. It's got to be the way it's supposed to be. But really? I mean, does that ring true to you? And so, you know, you don't need to have some kind of new utopian system. You just got to knock off the imperialism. It doesn't mean that the whole world is going to break out in perfect awesomeness. But the truth of the matter is that, well, I don't know the truth of the matter. My guess is that the most optimistic, capitalistic economists of the 19th century could have never predicted the truth of how the beauty, as Sheldon Richmond puts it at fff.org, of the market system and how rapidly capital can be produced and saved and reinvested and saved to improve the standards of living of people in the world. And you know, I don't know, man. Once you give people things, usually they become pretty conservative and stop trying to risk it. And that can mean they'll be more willing to go to a fake war under the impression that it's necessary to protect what they have. But it could also mean that, you know, in a future where people, never mind the states that claim legitimacy to rule them, but where people all over the world and private companies all over the world have such entrenched international relations with each other in trade and transfer of all kinds that it becomes almost impossible. It is becoming more difficult, I should say, for states to go to war. In fact, you know, here's something I don't know a damn thing about and should, but I just read someone sort of mentioned offhand in, I think they're in the context of talking about the horror in Somalia. In fact, I think it was our friend Francis Nesbitt, who we interviewed on the show about Somalia. In the intro to his article, I'm almost certain it was him. The article would be at fpif.org. Francis Nesbitt. And anyway, I'm pretty sure in there, it's where he says, you know, there's almost what you could consider a golden age going on in Africa right now, relatively speaking. The end of the Cold War, the end of most colonialism, with the exception of where America is turning everything upside down. They actually have been doing some good. And part of that, believe it or not, and you know what, I don't know all the data, but part of that is the IMF setting up rules that say, no, you have to have regular elections and you have to have a separate judiciary and some things like this in order to get the corrupt loans. And I guess it's not true that in every case, an IMF loan is nothing but a way to, you know, trick a third world country into giving up all of its resources. In some cases, at least there are some silver linings where you get better protections of property rights, lower taxation, accountability by electoral process, certainly comparatively to the way the previous systems had worked. And guess what capitalism is doing for Africa? It's getting people fed. It's actually getting them bank accounts with meager savings in them, you know? It's helping. I don't think that that people could have ever really imagined back in the past just how rapidly things can change, you know? What does it mean to spread 100 million laptops around the world to countries where they only just turned their lights on? They only just finally got their power grid up and running in a way where it's reliable, and now, blam, they got Windows 7. We're living in an age of miracles, really. Peace is breaking out all over. There are hardly any wars. Every single war really in the world right now is an American war, one way or the other. And that includes in the Congo. Those of you who are longtime listeners of this show probably have heard me say, I don't know if the Congo, and then I come to find out, oh no, yeah, it's all about the Congo. You know, America is up to their eyeballs. The CIA and the military are up to their eyeballs in backing death squads. Probably on all sides of that one too. Otherwise, in the rest of the world, they're running out of peacekeepers. There's too many treaties. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Scott Horton Show. We're on Liberty Express Radio, No Agenda Radio, scotthorton.org, and other things. I think maybe we're on the Daily Poll now, too. I'm not certain if that's up and going yet. Anyway, thanks very much for tuning in. First guest up on the show today, is our friend Phil Giraldi, Executive Director of the Council for the National Interest and writer for the American Conservative and Antiwar.com. And man, you got some... former CIA, former DIA officer as well. And boy, you got some breaking news for us here in the American Conservative magazine, or at least on their website, theamericanconservative.com today, Phil.
They posted an article that actually appeared in the magazine version, which came out a few days ago.
Oh, okay.
Which I had written a couple weeks ago. It's about Syria, and basically it explains the background to the decision of the White House to issue a position paper on justification to go to war with Syria. What the piece explains is that the intelligence community, in the form of a number of senior analysts, basically staged a revolt and refused to allow the argument, the paper, to go out from the intelligence community because they did not have a very high, very good feeling for the credibility of the information.
Wow. And isn't that something else, too? Because people probably remember that at the time, you and others were reporting, or I guess it was pretty obvious right away to critics that, hey, wait a minute, this dossier is not a CIA product. This came from the White House, and they use a lot of CIA-ish language to sort of, you know, fool the Chuck Todds of the world or something like that. But you can't get that by Gareth Porter, Phil Giraldi, and you guys immediately were going, well, wait a minute, how come this is a White House product and not a CIA product?
Yeah, that's precisely the issue, because the obviously the normal pattern for this kind of thing would be for the Director of National Intelligence or the head of the CIA basically to come out with the document and say this is the consensus of the intelligence community. But in this case, the intelligence community didn't have any consensus. They felt that a lot of the information was dubious in nature, and that some of it was even quite likely fraudulent. And a number of analysts basically went to Clapper, the DNI, and to Brenner at CIA and said, look, we're not going to sign on to this. And if this document goes out as a CIA or DNI document, we are going to resign and go public with it.
Wow. And can you tell us a ballpark estimate how many different CIA analysts we're talking about were willing to go that far?
You know, I don't really know. I tried to pin that down in terms of numbers, but apparently the number was significant. It was a big enough number where it wouldn't have been like in the lead up to the Iraq War, there were a few resignations. This would have been more in the nature of a mass resignation. A number of people, very reputable among the analytical community, resigning and making very clear what the issue was. So they really what they were saying is, you know, we don't want to repeat of the George Tenet sitting in the United Nations behind Colin Powell and vouching for information that he knew was false to create a case to go to war. Because the aftermath of that was, of course, the intelligence community was blamed. And the fact is, of course, there were a lot of people that should not have been blamed because they knew damn well the information was wrong and they had said so. But the political leadership of the agency and in the White House basically wanted a war.
Right, yeah, and of course, Tenet later claimed that when he told George Bush that it was a slam dunk case, that when they said that they're basically almost lying about him, taking that out of context, because he did not mean that it was a slam dunk case that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What he meant was it's a slam dunk case that you can get the American people to go along with this war if you can make them believe that there are chemical weapons in Iraq. That was his defense.
That's exactly what he was doing. He was saying that it was a slam dunk, politically speaking, that they could sell it.
Yeah.
But the fact was, you know, I was at CIA when this was going on, and there was a lot of chatter in the halls and everything, and people saying, you know, this just doesn't make sense. This information doesn't support what they're saying. And so there were a lot of people, if I knew about it at my lowish level in the agency, there were a lot of people that knew that this was going on.
Mm-hmm. And now, in fact, wasn't it, what's it called, WINPAC or something? It's sort of this separate little part of the CIA that specializes in WMD. And they, I guess, Joe or Mike or Jim or somebody from there was the one who was the world's greatest champion of the bogus aluminum tube story.
Yeah, that's true. I don't really recall who it was exactly. That would have been part of the, all of that stuff was part of the proliferation staff that dealt with all those issues, and they were very specialized people, and I didn't really have much contact with them.
I always forget the name of that little sub-agency. It always reminds me of WinEP, but that's different. Slightly. all right, and now, well, by the way, so then in 02 and early 03 then, was it common knowledge in the halls at the CIA that Donald Rumsfeld and Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle are running their own little separate Office of Special Plans, digging through y'all's trash, looking for something that can seem like a case?
Well, it wasn't common knowledge. There were people at the higher levels that knew it because they had objected to it. In fact, Tenet, at several points, objected to the fact that this information was being stovepiped through the system. And, you know, so it was known at higher levels, but most of the people at middle levels, and so it didn't see the evidence of this, because this stuff was not going through CIA. It was going directly to the White House. So it was, there was not much opportunity to see it. But if people, you know, if an experienced analyst had looked at this stuff, he would have said it was garbage. But they didn't give them the chance to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, as Wilkerson said, though, they threw out the Libby speech entirely, and the one that they wrote for the United Nations was wholly with the cooperation of the CIA and was not... That part of it, anyway, the Powell speech at the UN was the CIA stuff. And that was bogus enough. I don't know why they even needed Doug Feith.
Yeah, well, I guess they didn't eventually. But the fact was that Tenet was a political player, and he was quite willing to go along with the charade. And when you say it was coordinated with CIA, it was coordinated with Tenet and the people immediately around him. Mm-hmm. And those are all political players that are interested in supporting the White House, whatever it wants to do. And so that's the kind of result you get.
Right. All right. Well, we should change the subject back to what we're talking about here with this current day stuff. It occurs to me that people in the audience, probably many of them, ought to go ahead and start patting themselves on the back. Anyone who suspected that the Israeli intercept of the Syrians ordering this chemical weapons attack might be fabricated. Apparently, that was the exact same conversation going on at Langley, Virginia at the very same time. So, what a bunch of kooks aren't.
Yeah, there was a lot of suspicion both at the Pentagon. You know, these are Pentagon analysts, too, that I don't want to say this is all CIA. In fact, I think the evidence that I've gotten is that there were more people at the Pentagon that were upset about this and were complaining about the information they were getting than there actually were at CIA. So was like across the government that people were looking at this information and saying it was it just didn't work.
So that would mean DIA or Navy intelligence or?
Well, the Pentagon has a whole lot of different intelligence groups within it. DIA would be the obvious one that had most of the analysts, and they were certainly the ones that were in the forefront of this. And so anyway, they were saying, look, this Israeli intelligence comes through very conveniently when we're looking for something to pin it on al-Assad. And they were very skeptical about it for a whole lot of reasons. And as I point out in the article, for example, there was no corroborative intelligence from U.S. satellites or U.S. snoopers, U.S. sources on the ground to indicate that to support what the Israelis were claiming.
Mm-hmm. And now, that's interesting enough. I mean, I don't want to believe in them too much, but it seems like if the Israelis were able to intercept something like that, the NSA would have picked it up too, right? Or one of their Five Eye or a Million Eye partners out there?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I think that would be, we're talking basically about telephone conversations. The Israelis have a semi-secret unit, which is like a field unit that is deployed on a border close to where they want to pick up communications. So they have a good capability to get in close and pick up things that maybe aren't strong enough signals to be picked up by NSA. But at the same time, as they say, the thing that was odd about this was that if indeed the phone conversation were true with a Syrian army officer, first of all, the conversation itself, even as reported by the Israelis, was somewhat ambiguous. And secondly, the United States satellites, which were focused on this area, would have picked up on the preparations that were that are necessary to launch a chemical attack. The Syrian arsenal is what they call binary chemical systems, which means they have to be combined. You have to see, you know, you will see the actual process of the chemicals being combined and armed onto the missiles. And then, of course, there's also the problem that the missiles that were shown in the news coverage of this were missiles that were not even in the Syrian arsenal. So there were a lot of problems with the story, and this is precisely what the analysts at both the Pentagon and CIA and the Office of the DNI were focused on when they said, no, this stuff just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, it seemed like the direction that the shells came from was everything, according to not just John Kerry, but I guess all the media that seemed to agree, or I guess that was a UN report too, right? Was that, well, geez, when we trace all these shells back to where they came from, it's this base, U.S. or Syrian government army base.
Yeah. The only problem with that is, I mean, you know, how do you trace a trajectory ex post facto? I mean, you got the exploded missiles on the ground. What kind of evidence do you have? How do you get a sideways shot that shows you what their trajectory is? I can't quite figure that one out. And it was
or they
Kerry,
go,
actually,
I guess, by the crater, the shape of the crater, but that's certainly not ironclad, you know.
Sure, that would give you a divergence of 90 degrees or something like that in terms of where it came from. And this was Kerry's comment, actually. I don't think the United Nations ever confirmed that or said that they felt that that was conclusive evidence. I don't think they did. But anyway, in any event, you know, all of this information, just there were lots of holes in this information. And so clearly it was an issue of, you know, is this stuff for real or is it not? Or do we go to war? I mean, you know, bombing Syria is an act of war. And do we go to war based on another group or another collection of information that that doesn't quite hang together? Well, that's essentially what the analysts were saying.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's amazing the politics of that thing looking back. I mean, it's just... It's almost a fairy tale ending the way that they all of a sudden went with this, you know, Russian plan to just get rid of the chemical stocks that remain and stay out. I mean, can you imagine America staying out of a thing? And mostly, I think, because the American people insisted. I guess the Pentagon really didn't want to get in there too bad either. But
No.
But it's amazing that they were willing to even get near to this. Based on such shoddy intelligence that they're willing. I mean, Obama, on one hand, is saying, well, I can't get the CIA to tell the story I want him to tell, so I'll go ahead and have my guys tell it themselves, you know, from the White House. And then on the other hand, he's telling Congress, why don't you guys do a conscience vote, which means go ahead and tell me no. I don't mind, basically, right?
That's right. Right, and of course the basic premise, which was, you know, we have to stop them from killing more Syrian civilians by killing some Syrian civilians of our own. Right. It was like a solution that was no solution, and the whole thing was so stupid. It was hard to imagine that a serious government, not headed by Peter Sellers, could actually come up with this plan.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the only real negative thing I can find anybody saying about it really is that, well, it makes America look like a bumbling clown and all that, but I don't mind that at all, you know? In fact, if that makes the D.C. types feel a little bit embarrassed and a little bit more reluctant to stick their neck out so far on something like this next time, so much the better.
Yeah. We have to say that every time one of these plans is revealed, it's a blessing for all of us because it's... Maybe that won't happen again.
Right. Well, I think call waiting just screwed you up there. Phil, you want to say that last one again?
Yeah, I'm sorry. The call waiting is clicking.
Yeah. We just lost a few words was all. But anyway, I think we got the point. So, hey, listen, I want to know what you think about what happened last weekend with these Iran talks, man. I really thought it was going to happen, but then other things happened. Are you there? Oh. Well, the light's still green.
Scott, are you still here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, we got messed up on my phone here. What happened last week, obviously, the French were motivated by two things. I mean, the first was they had assurances from the Saudis that the Saudis would buy lots of weapons from France if France did the right thing vis-a-vis blocking an agreement with Tehran. So they had that, and then, of course, they were under pressure from the Israelis. And, you know, it's France has a very large Jewish population. The population is very political and very involved with the government. Hollande, in fact, the François Hollande, is in Israel right now. And anyway, so there was a lot of leverage coming from active French partisans for Israel on the French government to block this. And so they did it. They had two good reasons, they thought, and they did it. And the question is this something that has so screwed up the process that it can't go forward from here or not? And that's what scares me a little bit. I have a feeling that we had our opportunity, and maybe we blew it.
Yeah. You know, it's really something else, I guess. I mean, I don't know, maybe this is the mythology of the American superpower or something, but God, it just seems like if John Kerry had grabbed the French guy by the arm and had said, hey man, don't do this or you're going to piss me off and I'm going to do something back to you or something like that, that it wouldn't have happened, right? If the Americans were serious.
I think that's true, but I think what happened here was that the Americans and everybody else were blindsided. They didn't expect this to come from the French, and when it came from the French, it was late in the process, and there really wasn't any way to recover from it.
Yeah.
So I suspect that would be the right way to view it. As I say, the question is, are these really things that the French are going to go to the wall about? Because they do have veto power in the UN. They're one of the five nations that do have that. So it becomes a question of, to what extent is this a serious game being played by the French or something they were just paying off favors or trying to get some special treatment? And, of course, it's too early to tell that. But as I said, the real danger here is that it's damaged the process. For example, you can see it already in the United States, where Congress is now cranking itself up at the behest of AIPAC, essentially to block Obama from doing anything. So it's bought Congress some time to get this going, and which is a bad thing, because if Kerry had come back with a deal last week, it would have been very hard for Congress to say no.
Right. Yeah, you know, I even saw where Obama said that the sanctions were a path to war. The American people don't want this path to war. And boy, I wish he would make up his mind what the hell he wants and try to come up, I don't know, hire somebody else's chief of staff or somebody to come and help this guy figure out what the hell he wants and how to do it, because this is just ridiculous, man. I don't know. Good thing for him he was running against John McCain and Mitt Romney. Otherwise, how did this boob ever become the president of the United States? I can't figure it out.
Yeah, well, that's the same thing I keep asking, but of course, I then think of John McCain and Mitt Romney and Sarah Palin, and I say, well, thank God we have them.
Yeah, well, and the blowback from George Bush, too, is what caused it, but yeah, and then the thank God it's not Mitt Romney right now, yeah. Well, no, so Rothkopf from foreignpolicy.com wrote a thing saying that actually, you know, the Americans were worried, he kind of read the politics the other way, that if they'd come home with this partial deal in the midst of the rising political storm at home, it might have fallen apart, and that maybe the Americans had decided, I think he claims to know, that the Americans had decided to not push back against the French, that they would take this out for a little bit of breathing room so that they could try to cool off the domestic politics a little bit more and then come back in 10 days with their support a little bit more shored up. But that's an awful risk.
Yeah.
If it's true.
I hope he's right. I mean, obviously, I'd like to see this succeed. And I hope he's right. But I find that a little bit, I'm not too sure about it.
Yeah. Well, now, so how's the Mujahideen doing in Syria these days?
Well, let me see. The reports, of course, today from Aleppo about how Aleppo is becoming an all Sharia city, and if you don't comply with Sharia, you get killed. So I guess that's how the Mujahideen are doing, and I hope everybody's proud about their support of the rebels in Syria. As you well know, I was one of the first ones screaming that this whole rebel Syria insurgency and everything was a load of crap, and that it was not going to turn out very well. So anyway,
I feel vindicated,
but it's not a good vindication.
Yeah. Well, you're also the guy that broke the story that Obama had signed the new finding authorizing stepped-up support for the Mujahideen back in December of 2011 at Antiwar.com,
right.
Washington's
mm-hmm.
Secret Wars. So I'm reading this thing. I don't know what to make of this thing in The Guardian about Riyadh is fighting two wars in Syria. They're backing a whole new rebel force that they're training up. This is one we spoke about, maybe. This is one we spoke about a couple of weeks ago that Jaynes claimed that the Americans were training them in Saudi Arabia. But anyway,
right.
This Guardian piece says that, well, I guess Bandar's plan is to use them against the Al-Qaeda guys, which would be ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, and then these mm-hmm. guys will be the ones to take the lead then and defeat Assad when they're done with the Mujahideen. Although, hadn't the Saudis been backing the Jabhat al-Nusra and the ISIS guys all along, and why would they quit that now?
Well, I think that the only reason they would quit it now, or at least pretend to quit it now, is that there's been a lot of international pressure on them because of the radicalism, the demonstrated radicalism of the rebels. I don't think they had a problem with it until suddenly this stuff started coming to light. Before that, they were probably quite comfortable with it. And, there's been some media coverage about how the Saudis, are kind of a worse enemy in terms of internationally, in terms of the extremist form of Islam that they've been propagating around the world. And that basically this is the seedbed of a lot of these radical movements. I would not take the Saudis at face value.
Yeah, so we could believe that they're backing up a force here, but not that they're going to use them to limit, to try to take on al-Nusra. Certainly not before the Ba'athists, anyway.
Well, if their intention is to bring about regime change, which it is, they're going to support everybody that basically has that same objective. I mean, that's just the way they're going to work, and that's, to a certain extent, it's common sense in terms of what their objectives are. So I think that they will be supporting the extreme groups, they will be supporting moderate groups, they'll be supporting whoever they can support that they think might be effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then, so what about Bashar al-Assad? I mean, you mentioned Aleppo and their at least attempt to institute Sharia law there. Do they have the regime on the run, or does this just mean more Hezbollah and more Iranian support for Assad and Russian support and on the war will go? Or,
well, I mean, all the indications seems to be, I mean, I have no special information on this, but all the indications from people on the ground seem to be that the government is clearly winning right now. Today it took one of the last suburbs in Damascus that had that was controlled by the rebels, and that its forces are moving on Aleppo, which is, of course, the principal business city and the largest city in Syria. It looks like the rebels are not doing very well, and that's possibly why the Saudis in particular are panicking. It's not exactly a situation where somebody's going to win next week. This is a situation that's taken years to develop. It's going to take years to resolve.
Yeah. Well, do you think it's much in question whether Syria is even going to outlast this battle?
It could become a collection of autonomies in the way that Iraq is going. So that would seem to be the likely outcome. The Kurdish region of Syria has basically gone autonomous already, and obviously the Sunni Shia conflict, which is developing, sort of projects itself to become the same sort of thing for the rest of the country.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like we saw in Iraq where the Sunnis can't retake Baghdad, but the Shiite government in Baghdad can't really occupy the Sunni triangle. In fact, I guess Coburn was reporting they had even withdrawn, at least for a time, and sort of given up even the attempt. So I wonder, It's speculating, but I wonder whether we'll actually see what some of these kooks have talked about. And I mean the kooks, the suicide bomber types, the Al-Nusra types have talked about. Well, hey, you know what? Maybe we can't take Damascus and we'll just make an alliance with the Sunni Triangle part of... that's not what he called it, but that's what he's talking about. We'll just make an alliance with the Sunni parts of Iraq, and we'll have a new Sunni stand here. It'll be the beginning of the Islamo-fascist caliphate of bin Laden and George W. Bush's dreams.
Sure, and there'll be a Kurdistan in the north, which will unite the Kurdish regions of Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Iraq. Sure, anything is possible.
Yeah, and then we'll all have a nuclear war. It'll be great. No, I mean, that's the one that's the real problem, right, is the interests of all those states in trying to keep their Kurdish populations divided from each other and inside their states. I mean, can you imagine the Iranians letting their part of Kurdistan go?
Yeah, well, that's the whole issue that people are forgetting now, that the Kurdish issue is a much bigger regional issue than even Sunni Shia in terms of the individual countries, because Kurdistan, it spans all four countries, and it's a significant part of the population in all four countries. Mm-hmm. So this could be interesting to watch. But, of course, we Americans are the ones who triggered this by invading Iraq.
Yeah. Well, why you got to bring up old stuff? What's that got to do with anything?
The surge worked, Scott.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, say it six times and it starts sounding true. Hey, listen, so, you know, Mohammed Sahimi was on the show, and he was reminding us about American and or Israeli support for PJAK, the communist Kurdish terrorists.
Right.
They're like the PKK, mm-hmm. but more focused on Iran, right? What's up with that lately?
I haven't heard much on it lately, but I would assume it's still active. I don't know to what extent. I mean, they'd be operating out of the Kurdish part of Iraq, and they still have good ties in that area, both the U.S. military and intelligence community, and also the Israelis. So I would suspect that's still an active program. I wouldn't be surprised if PJAK is involved with some of these assassinations and bombings in Tehran. Mm. They've been blamed on the on MEC to a large extent, and that has a certain logic to it. But you know, the Kurds have the same ability to carry out these acts. They can pass as Iranians. They can move around.
Now there were even in the middle of all the negotiations there, or in between negotiations. There with first and second Geneva meetings, there were Jandala attacks on border guards in Baluchistan in southeast Iran. I know there's a history going back there of CIA and Mossad pretending to be CIA and whoever else. Do you think that was Mossad did that, or they're just acting on their own?
I would tend to think at this point, and from that area, they're acting on their own. But certainly they were enabled pretty much by the United States possibly acting with Mossad in the beginning to get this thing started.
Right. All right, we got to go. Thanks so much, Phil. Appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. Bye-bye.
That's Phil Giraldi, everybody, from the Council for the National Interest, the American Conservative Magazine, and antiwar.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, you all, welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003 at scotthorton.org. And, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. If you like following me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, /Scott Horton Show. And then, you know, you can retweet me, and I'll retweet you, and we'll have a great time. Okay, so there's a guy who wrote a thing. I'm going to try to get him on the show. The hell's his name? Matthew Akins. I haven't had a chance to try to get in touch with him. Maybe today I will. But he wrote this thing for Rolling Stone about the A-Team killings, the torture and murder by these Army Rangers, second tier Special Forces guys in Afghanistan, and including some footage of their supposed translator, I guess, is his official title involved in it. So, it's definitely worth a read. I don't know if I'll be able to get the guy on the show or not, but I'm going to try to. That's at rollingstone.com. It's called The A-Team Killings. Pretty tough stuff. Gareth Porter coming up on the show. At the bottom of the hour. And tomorrow, Andy Worthington is going to be on the show, by the way. Ain't that make you happy? Well, we've got some Guantanamo horror show to discuss with him, so we will. And then, there's a few different things I wanted to mention. No, I'm trying to pick. I got to call Jason in just a second, but he needed a minute, so I'm giving it to him. Leopold, that is. Well, I guess I'll just mention these two stupid, not very important things, and then one important one. First of all, I saw Jon Stewart last night, and he did this great whole thing about the Iran talks until he got to the part about they fell apart, and then he cut to Samantha Bee, who I really like, but who, I forgot even what her point was, but it had nothing to do with, well, what happened? And come on, man, the story is that America is doing all this for Israel in the first place, and then Israel helped, at least, to screw it up. How come that's too sensitive for the Daily Show? Come on. That was the punchline. And you know what? If people are so afraid that you can't make fun of Israel at all without completely delegitimizing it, maybe it's because what Israel is doing is completely and totally illegitimate. You know? What confident king is afraid of his joker? But Jon Stewart just can't touch what happened. Couldn't happen to have anything to do with the leaders of those who are threatening war all the time. He made it just about America. No mention of Israel at all. I mean, come on. What are you so afraid of? I don't necessarily just blame it on him, his producers, whatever. But there had to have been a conversation there where they just said, no, we're not going to do that, right? Well, why not? Benjamin Netanyahu's all over TV denouncing it in public. He's sending his men to come and go to our Congress to try to prevent our president from making this deal. It's in the Wall Street Journal, man. But we'll have Sam B. crack a joke about his shoes or some crap. Whatever. That's disappointing to me. The other thing is this Richard Cohen thing. All the liberals are doing their racial thought police thing because Richard Cohen wrote this essay. He's a writer for the Washington Post, in case you're way too intelligent to waste a moment of your life reading the Washington Post. It's certainly their editorial page. Anyway, I only read it when I heard there was some controversy, and then I went to look for the controversy, and what's the big deal? Everybody's saying he's a racist, but he's not a racist. The point of the article is he's assuming that everybody except him is a racist. So, yeah, he's a racist. He's an East Coast liberal Jewish guy who is racist against working class white folks and assume that they all are racist against black folks. But it's just not true. And then somebody helpfully found the poll that said actually 87% of Americans support interracial relationships and marriage and families and don't care about that at all. What in the hell are you talking about, you kook? But the only reason this is interesting to me at all is because nobody got it right at all. There are all the PC police going, oh, you're a racist white guy. And then there are all the right-wingers going, well, oh, you guys are such PC police. Well, but he was being racist against white guys, calling them racist against black guys. How come nobody's saying that? I mean, I'm not a Tea Party right-winger. And in fact, I think in a lot of ways, the Tea Party is a bunch of racist nitwits. Or at least, if there was a previous time, they would be racist. You know, they're over it now, thank goodness. But more or less, Richard Cohen is right that this is sort of the right-wing populist fringe that used to be called the Dixiecrats. They used to be much more animated by issues of race than they are now, but it's still the same people. You could see why he thinks that a little bit. But anyway, I just think that if anybody sinned at all, it was Richard Cohen. But his sin was in calling other people racist when he had no good cause to. Not that he's a racist himself, even though, of course, he probably is that, too. I don't mind saying it. He obviously thinks an Iraqi's life is worth nothing. Oh, I mean, it's worth so much that it's worth it to kill as many of them as you have to make their nation paradise from now on, so that then the rest of them will be so cared for. Good old Washington Post editorial page. That's where we learn things. And then, I don't know enough about this to really go off, so I'll just try to make it a punchline. Hey, guess what? The Stuxnet virus is infecting nuclear power plants in America and could affect nuclear power plants around the world. So says somebody or other. How do you like that? America and Israel's cyber warfare attack could cause, I don't know, use your scariest imagination if you want to. Use your most conservative imagination. By that I mean paranoid, you know. About what that might mean for your town, especially if you live in the Northeast where there's nuclear power plants everywhere. Anyway. Somebody wrote on my Facebook page about, yay, blowback, we love it and want more and whatever. And in a way, isn't that kind of what America keeps saying? All right, horrific consequences for our bad decisions. Let's keep making them. It's hard to paraphrase it any tighter than that without getting the exact quote, you know? That's how I feel. Anyway, hang on one sec, man. We'll be right back. This thing plays. Oh, good. What the? God dang it, Bobby. What are you doing to me? You know, sometimes. All right. Okay, that's not going to work. Oh, I know what happened. You know what happened? File in the wrong place. Couldn't find it. Went to the next one. Okay, here, Beasties. You guys like the Beasties, right? Here, Beasties. This is the original, original version. Y'all, welcome back. I got Jason on the phone. Jason Leopold, now writing for Al Jazeera, America.AlJazeera.com, I think it is. Where the hell is this article? Holy journalism, Batman. Welcome back to the show. Jason, how are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me back on.
Very happy to have you here. Wow, tell the people about this great scoop you got. Where'd you get it?
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say that.
Oh, okay. But this is not a Freedom of Information Act thing. This is, you were leaked, correct?
Yes.
All of Abu Zubaydah's journals going back to the early 1990s? The whole
yes,
kit and caboodle.
His six volumes of diaries that he wrote between 1990 and 8 days before his capture in March of 2002. And Abu Zubaydah, in case people are not completely aware of who he is the first high-value, so-called high-value detainee captured after 9/11. He is the one who the torture memo written by John Yoo was written specifically for. He is mentioned in the infamous presidential daily brief of August 2001, warning George W. Bush, quote, bin Laden determined to strike U.S. He is also tied to dozens of other Guantanamo prisoners, and their detention is basically linked to the fact that they were, you know, associates, alleged associates of Zubaydah. So these are incredibly important documents. I will say that I did actually file a Freedom of Information Act, Scott, for these diaries 2 years ago. I and as recently as 2 months ago. And I filed that with the Department of Defense because these documents, and I should say that I have the English, the government's translations of the Arabic.
But unredacted, correct?
Completely unredacted. And the government or the Department of Defense denied my request for the diaries. And they said that if they were released to me, it would potentially jeopardize or you know his potential charges before a military commission, and the you know the Justice Department just simply denied turning them over. But you know these diaries are so important because it is more or less the bulk of the evidence that the government you know has against him in whatever their case is. And these diaries have been used to you know build a psychological profile of him to exploit his fears. It's important as well because it tells this unbelievable compelling story, Scott, certainly about the events leading up to 9/11 and the aftermath following the U.S. invasion. But going back even further, he talks about the role of jihadists, of mujahideen, in Afghanistan, which was supported by the U.S. At one time, and his involvement with these groups and his fight on the front lines there, and so he's really present at the rise of Al-Qaeda, which he talks about, the arrival of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which he also talks about, and it's just a fascinating look at certainly at this complex figure that he turned out to be.
All right, now,
he's okay. Really it's amazing insight.
Mm-hmm. All right, now I want to get into as much of that as we can, but a couple of notes here. First of all, what is your confidence in the translation here in the documents that this is? Are you certain, for example, that this is a product prepared by lower CIA people for their higher-ups, that they would have every reason to get it as right as they could kind of thing, as compared to some story they're selling you?
Yeah, I mean, I did check on the authenticity of it, and, his lawyers are even, confident with regard to that as well.
Okay.
And let me just say that there have been many claims made about Abu Zubaydah.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, about who he is, what his role is, and it's pretty clear that there's a chunk of these diaries that would not make the U.S. look very good, particularly what we've learned later on. So,
mm-hmm. Hold it just one sec, because I wanted to ask you about the narrative that exists in some places anyway, and. Well, I'll leave the footnotes out because I don't want to get it wrong who wrote what. But more or less, I'm under the impression, I guess I should say, that the CIA was torturing this guy or they wanted to. The FBI was questioning him and they were getting somewhere and then the CIA took him away and tortured him, whatever. Bush used him over and over again in press conferences as the reason that we had to torture people. Like, man, there's this Zubaydah guy, we tortured him, and then he sang like a canary, and we saved all your lives over and over again because of what he told us. And then, according to Ron Suskin, Bush got in a big fight with George Tenet because at some point, George Tenet, the head of the CIA, came and said, actually, that's not right. And Bush got mad at him and said, well, I already said he was important. So now you're going to make me lose face. Oh, and then
right.
Part of that, too, was that the FBI said that the CIA is crazy if they think that this guy's the big kingpin because he's crazy. If you look at his diaries, he's obviously a madman and couldn't possibly have been in charge of anything. But that's not the impression I'm getting from your journalism here. So,
no, it's absolutely wrong that, Dan Coleman, former FBI special agent, who basically put out that narrative and passed it along to Ron Suskind, who wrote the book The 1% Doctrine, basically, stating that evidence of his insanity was his diaries. And the what was behind that was that, as Suskind wrote in his book, that Zubaydah wrote to these various versions of himself, called Hani 1, Hani 2, Hani 3. Hani is the nickname that his parents gave him. But Zubaydah makes it so clear, Scott, in these diaries, why he chose to speak to another version of himself. And he says that, I am writing to a 30-year-old version of myself because I don't have any friends, and I need someone to talk to. And then he adds that, I'm not schizophrenic. I'm not insane. I'm not a crazy person. This is me paraphrasing here, for doing this. So he's stating that explicitly. You have to wonder, how could, an FBI special agent attached to, the CIA's Bin Laden unit would come away with reviewing the diaries believing that this person is, quote, certifiable, split personality. There's absolutely no way, Scott, that these, you know, that he is mentally unstable as the FBI claimed.
No, I get it. I mean, look, FBI agents think a lot of things, and almost none of them are ever correct about anything. So that I can understand how that goes in the category. Even if the CIA are the bad guys in the story, that they're the ones torturing him, that doesn't mean that the FBI have a clue what they're talking about. So
yeah, I think
we
that
can
it was
dispense
basically
with that. I'll let you get back to your story, because you got a hell of a story to tell here. I just want to clarify a couple of those things to start, is all.
Yeah, no, I think that's important, because that's the narrative out there. So, excuse me, the first diary that I wrote about, this was the first installment. It's part of this series. You know, the diaries, the government translations are more than 800 pages. And, you know, the first one, he's a computer engineering student in India. He's attending college. He's very lonely. Zubaydah is grew up in Saudi Arabia. He's of Palestinian descent. Doesn't have many friends. He sits around at night listening to Chris de Burgh, the soft FM rock tunes of Chris de Burgh, who is best known for the song "The Lady in Red." I don't know if you recall that, but he says that, you know, his only friend is a cigarette, and you can get the sense that this is a person who's very depressed. He decides, at the urging of a friend, to one day go to Afghanistan for training. This was in January of 1991, and he gets to Afghanistan, and his plan was to, you know, go into this training camp and return to India, you know, to finish his studies. And keep in mind that, you know, at this time, basically anyone can enter this training camp called Khaldan Training Camp, which goes back to, you know, which was supported by the U.S. and goes back to, the 80s when you know, the Mujahideen were, fighting against the Soviets. But he gets there, and suddenly he's sort of embraced by, you know, all of these other, Mujahideen, and they welcome him in, and it's an experience he has clearly not felt before. And so he makes this decision that he's going to give up everything and go to what he calls the land of jihad, Afghanistan. And, you know, from there, you follow this unbelievable evolution of, you know, computer engineering student to student of jihad, you know, to a man who became this master forger, you know, forging documents, travel documents, passports, and, you know, encountering all of these infamous, you know, figures, including bin Laden, Mohammed Atef, former military, the deceased military leader of Al-Qaeda. I mean, he names names, Scott. He writes down every name, alias at least, of everyone he has encountered. And, you know, you get such great insight, first of all, into this growth of Al-Qaeda and the infighting between, you know, what Zubaydah wanted to do, which was what he called defensive jihad, and what, you know, bin Laden was promoting, which was offensive jihad, which is what he says. And there's, you know, a lot of infighting and there's competition, you know, among these groups. You just follow this story, which is, I mean, truly, it's very cinematic in a sense.
Yeah, well, and what a scoop. I mean, what an inside view. And now, so as far as Bush arguing with Tenet about how important the guy was, he was important, but he wasn't bin Laden's lieutenant is basically, I think, the point you're saying. He was important in other ways.
That's right. I mean, there are many instances throughout his diary, Scott, because he was, you know, I'm not sure what facilitator exactly means, but he was in charge of a guest house in, you know, Peshawar, Pakistan, and he calls himself sort of an administrator. He was basically the, you know, he would more or less meet everyone who, you know, would before they went into the training camps, they'd stop off at this, you know, at this guest house. And the guest house was, you know, called House of Martyrs. And so he would more or less meet everyone. He'd write down their names, write down some stories about them. But because he, you know, was the sort of, you know, the person that everyone saw first, his name was you know, mentioned often. And he would often say in his diaries that the Pakistani media, and this is going back, by the way, to the mid-90s, that they're continuously identifying him as, you know, bin Laden's, you know, closely linked with bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and he's next in line to run al-Qaeda. And he says in his diaries, I don't know why they're saying this. Where are they getting this information from? I'm not even a member of al-Qaeda. How could I become their leader? So, you know, he's critiquing these, you know, these news reports, and the fact that he is mentioned in these news reports, I mean, you could tell that he kind of likes it. He kind of likes the attention, but at the same time, you know, he's taking, you know, various security precautions. So, you know, seeing that in his diaries, you have to, you know, you wonder, like, why and how did we get it so wrong?
I mean, you talk about how he's writing with an eye toward an audience, an imagined audience that will get their hands on this thing one day, in a sense, too. So maybe he's just building in a little deniability. Who the hell's bin Laden? I don't know what you're talking about, kind of thing.
Sure, you know, I mean, but he does say at the same time, you know, in an early volume, you know, remind me to tell you one day about bin Laden and the al-Qaeda organization. Then he goes on to say that, I'm thinking of joining al-Qaeda, and this is a thought I've had for about 8 months since I arrived at the Al-Farouq training camp. Hmm. So, you know, and he's also very vocal or, you know, writing about, I shouldn't say vocal, but he's writing about, you know, how he fears that maybe these diaries will fall into the wrong hands and be used against him. So he is holding back, and that's much later on.
Oh, I see.
You know, you do get the sense that, you know, that it's authentic.
You know what? Hold it right there.
Hold
it right there. Let's take this break real quick, and let me keep you into the next segment. Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay, great. It's Jason Leopold, truthout.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Good old Gareth Porter. He took it in stride when I told him he's been bumped. Bumped! That's all right. He'll be on the show tomorrow. We already got to cover ground, the same ground with Phil Giraldi about the Iran talks, pretty much anyway. But that's all right. I want to hear it again. I want to hear it from Gareth, but that'll be tomorrow. For now, we're going to continue on with Jason Leopold. I said truth out just because that's my habit, but what I meant to say is aljazeera.com.
Yeah, no more truth out.
I'm sorry?
No more truth out.
No more truth out. Keep
no
the
more truth.
Out. Publish it at Al Jazeera. It's actually Gareth's article is a truth out. And it's a good one. But no, this is Zubeda Diary shed new light on Twin Towers and links to bin Laden. America.aljazeera.com. And of course, Abu Zubeda being one of the big stars of the terror war, at least as it was portrayed by the Bush regime in the first, you know, few years after September 11th, still being held down at Guantanamo Bay, was waterboarded. I guess he was the one who was waterboarded three times.
Yeah.
And Or wait, how many times was he waterboarded? It was Sheikh Mohammed was 187, right?
No, 83 times in a single month.
83. Right, right.
But I also just want to point out, Scott, is that, you know, for people coming to this the first time, it would be, you know, first of all, these are very lengthy stories. So anyone that's taken the time to read it, thank you. But the first one, last week...
I really enjoyed it. I think it's really great journalism. I really hope that people do. And you know what? Sometimes you can just sit and read an article real quick, and sometimes you got to devote a little bit of time to it. But, man, this one is worth it. This is really something else that you got here.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, but go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that the first installment will sort of, you know, sort of sets it up to really sort of understand, you know, this character, this person, Abu Zubaydah. And so, you know, reading that first before going into this one today, which sort of, you know, jumps forward 10 years to 9/11, is sort of crucial to sort of, you know, get a better understanding of, you know, of who he is, what was happening in his mind. I mean, you know, I'm not sure if I mentioned, Scott, but, you know, one of his greatest fears when he went to Afghanistan, that he writes about in 1991, was, what will I do if there's no more jihad? Here I am devoting my life to jihad, but what will I do if there's no more jihad?
That was the problem they all had.
I'm sorry?
That was the problem they all had. They couldn't go home anymore. Their only job skills was how to blow up stuff.
Yeah, he was really worried about this. I mean, he was worried. He was, you know, fearful that you know, he won't have anything to fall back on. You fast forward about, you know, a decade, and this camp that he's closely associated with, Khaldun Camp, you know, was shut down by the Taliban to sort of try and bring everyone under, you know, Osama bin Laden's wing or under his umbrella. And you know, you get the sense that, you know, Zubaydah is suddenly his greatest fear is about to come true. What will I do if there's no more jihad? And
that's what they say every day in D.C. and Virginia, too.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, and I think that's part of what's so fascinating here is sort of bearing witness to his, you know, his desperation. And he shows up in Afghanistan in mid 2001, around May or June of 2001. He says he always loses track of time when he's ever in Afghanistan, but he has $50,000, and he says, you know, not much for an operation, you know, against the Jews and in against Israel. But I've talked with some of the brothers, and they'll support me, or they promise to support me later on. And you know, this is a real sort of change for him. At least the way he writes about it, because everything prior to that, it was really focused, so focused on you know, these jihadist operations in Tajikistan and Bosnia, all the places where, you know, what he says, you know, infidels invading Muslim lands. But obviously, you know, with Israel, it's, you know, if you understand, if you can sort of relate to what he's talking about, you know, that was his own sort of you know, struggle as well, that he had no identity, and he talks about that. And you know, this was sort of the same thing, getting people out of Palestine.
Mm-hmm. And then, so
what he calls the invaders out of Palestine, that is.
Mm-hmm. And then getting them out of there and just bring them to Afghanistan. But for what? I mean, bin Laden had a purpose for his army. What was Zubaydah training these guys to do?
Well, he says that he was basically, you know, what they were training for is just in case anyone came and, you know, and invaded your land, you would be prepared. That's why he says that Khaldun was this public camp. You could come and go as you pleased. Mm-hmm. You could come for a weekend, you know, participate in some training. You'd have that under your belt, and maybe down the road, if you know, you're called for jihad or you want to be ready for jihad, you'd be prepared, Scott. Mm-hmm. And you know, so that was what he was really focused on, as well as sort of hoping that there would be the creation of this, you know, Islamic state for Muslims.
Yeah, I mean, it did really become, ever since the Reagan years, and then all through the 90s still, it was just sort of a rite of passage for, among some Muslim men, to go to Afghanistan, Arabs, to go to Afghanistan and go through the training camps. And of course, people probably remember back, in the, especially like the first Bush administration years, about how they would pretend that anyone who'd ever been to Afghanistan before or who had laid eyes on one of these camps were automatically all members of Al-Qaeda and working for bin Laden on his mission against us, when really, you could have found people from towns all over the Middle East who went to those training camps sort of like a Eagle Scouts kind of a thing, or
exactly,
you know, being a private in the army and then being discharged kind of a thing. It didn't really make warriors and crazies and jihadists and anti-American terrorists out of all of them at all, but it made for a great talking point that it did. But so what
no,
you're telling me
I
is that that was Zubeda's roles. He just ran one of those training camps that Tom, Dick, and Harry would go and train in, but he was not really part of Al-Qaeda. So then, I mean, but he knew a lot, and you say that he helped them all celebrate on September 11th, right?
Yeah, no, he did. And, you know, and just to go on to your last point, that's why these diaries are really important. I mean, they really are, an important historical document. And to really understand, you know, this world of jihad, I mean, you're getting it directly from a person who was there, and that's, you know, highly unusual. I mean, we don't have anything like this out there, Scott. There aren't any diaries floating around by a person of, you know, Zubeda's stature. But after 9/11, sure, yes, he says that you know, after the news came out on the radio, lambs were slaughtered and juice and sweets were distributed to, you know, to celebrate, the attacks. And then the U.S. invaded, and his job was, you know, he says he was security. He was working security, and but he also, you know, talked about, you know, various meetings that he participated in with Mohammed Atef, who was, you know, killed in a drone strike, and he was the, you know, military leader at the time of Al-Qaeda. He said that, you know, the invasion had this unintended consequence of bringing all of these jihadist groups together from Pakistan and various tribes, you know, groups that never really got along with one another, but they all united, you know, against, you know, the U.S. after the, you know, the invasion.
And then when was he grabbed? The beginning of 02, right?
In March of 02. And so, you know, what is, as the Taliban, you know,
actually,
regime.
Actually, wait a minute. Before we get to that, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was thinking of this question, but I forgot it. Before we get to the capture part, what do you know of his role in planning any at all of Al-Qaeda's stuff at the time, whatever? Because I thought, and maybe I'm just going from memory here, this is not in your piece, but I thought I had learned that so many of these bogus orange alerts that were going on mostly to just scare everybody into letting them invade Iraq back in 02 was what it was really about more than anything else, but that most of those were beaten out of this guy. That he was the one who said, oh, yeah, a bank in New Jersey, a school in Texas, a bridge somewhere in Minnesota, or whatever nonsense, just made-up nonsense to try to, you know, that they would use all the time to raise the level from yellow to orange and back again, that they must have known wasn't true at the time. But am I wrong about that? Or,
no,
or
you're
he
not.
Was
I mean,
involved
they
in,
did.
Did he know
they
anything
did,
about that stuff, or it was all just made up out of whole cloth, or what?
Well, you know, of course the U.S. government will say otherwise. And Ali Soufan, who is the FBI special agent that wrote a book called The Black Banners and interrogated him, you know, still maintains that that's accurate. But, you know, others just say there's, you know, this is not true. You know, he sent everyone on a wild goose chase because they were, you know, torturing him. And they were also torturing him for, you know, intelligence on Iraq's connection, you know, fantasy connection to Al-Qaeda, in order to use that as more justification, you know, for the invasion. So
he never did implicate Iraq, though, did he? Or did he?
As far as I know, he didn't, but the emir of the training camp that he was closely associated with, that he writes about, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, did, and he was, you know, he was rendered to, I believe it was Egypt, and then eventually, you know, died in a jail in Libya. Supposedly, he, you know, committed suicide, Scott. And but it was everything that he provided that, you know, the U.S. used to show a, or to claim that there was a connection. So, I guess
part of the premise of my question that I didn't really state very well, Jason, was that it seemed like, you know, they would say, okay, for here's an example of a different sort, but kind of sort of the same, where Bush said, yeah, there's a threat to the library tower in Los Angeles, and how, yeah, what he means by that is once upon a time, a couple of guys sitting around talked about, well, maybe that could be one of the targets, but that... they were just taking it completely out of context. Sort of the same thing with Libby. It's like, yeah, we do have an Al-Qaeda guy that implicated Saddam Hussein after we beat it out of him and told him, just say the name Saddam and we'll stop hurting you, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what they did. I mean, so...
But so then, my point being, though, so was Zubeda, when he was saying, yeah, bank in New Jersey, did they ever... Was he involved in discussions like that? Or he would have just been making things up out of nothing because he really wasn't that close to the guys who would have been talking about those sorts of things, is what I'm trying to ask you.
You know, I'm not entirely clear about what he was involved with regard to those specific, you know, so-called threats that... you know, that he provided intel on. But it's pretty clear in his diary, Scott, that, you know, he knew certain things that were taking place. With regard to 9/11, he doesn't write as if he knew 9/11 specifically, that, you know, that there was going to be this attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, but he says that he knew something big was coming. Everybody knew something big was coming. And, you know, with regard to other operations, he also suggests or seems to suggest that, you know, he's aware of what's happening. But it's to me, it's not clear that, you know, with regard to the Brooklyn Bridge, because there was a threat there and on Wall Street, that he was involved in any of that. But I'll just go, you know, again, go to Afghanistan. He talks about that he was in this meeting with the secretary to Mullah Omar, with Mohammed Atef, and they were discussing, you know, the strategy and security with regard to, you know, how to handle the U.S. So he was privy to some meetings, maybe not all of them. I don't know, but he definitely was in some areas.
And so, you know, certainly must have been a useful target for intelligence. And, you know, I don't know if they have a case. What specific case are they trying to make against him in Guantanamo? I guess I was going to make the
question.
Case there,
you know,
before I interrupted myself, that maybe you could argue for the FBI interrogating him, if not CIA torturers, you know?
Well, I mean, yeah. And I think that, you know, it's the great question, you know, that you brought up about Guantanamo. It's entirely unclear, Scott. I mean, the government, the Justice Department says in court documents that the bulk of their case, for the most part, is contained in these 6 volumes of diaries, you know, that I obtained. But these diaries were written prior to, you know, the 9/11 attacks, and a little bit afterwards. So what would be their case? We've already seen how, you know, material support and conspiracy, you know, prior to 9/11 just, you know, was tossed out, that, you know, the D.C. Circuit said you can't make that retroactive because it wasn't a war crime. So we don't know what the case is against him. I think the fact of the matter is that he will never, ever be charged. I mean, he will probably die in Guantanamo or another, you know, detention facility. And, you know, that much seems pretty clear to me.
Now, so when the Americans invaded, he didn't fight at all? He just ran to Pakistan?
No, he was fighting. His fighting, you know, he doesn't write about, you know, I you know, was on the front lines here the way he does in the first volume, and talks about, you know, how he was really on the front lines, you know, fighting in the Civil War. Here, it actually, you know, what his descriptions of fighting is more or less retreat and hiding. So, you know, he talks about security But it, you know, it's mostly, you know, just sort of, it seems to be protecting, you know, some of the senior al-Qaeda figures and retreating, trying to get, you know, up into the mountains, trying to just eventually by foot, you know, make his way, you know, into Pakistan and help many of these, you know, old school Mujahideen jihadists escape.
So in a way, it sounds almost like they have a less of a case against him than they had against Khadr, which is, you know, Khadr at least was accused of defending himself.
Exactly. I mean, you know, if they're using the diaries, Scott, as the evidence, there's nothing in there where he's saying, I threw a grenade, you know, at a U.S. soldier. I shot this person. There's nothing there. The only thing that he talks about is his, you know, feelings about this was the right time to wage a war against the U.S., but he's also critical about what, you know, bin Laden did, because it's simply just a declaration of war. A real war would look much different. And then aside from that, it's let's help, you know, he's helping everyone escape. So that's pretty much it. I mean, it's fascinating because it really is action-packed. I mean, it's very visual, where he's writing about, you know, the drone strikes, the civilian, hundreds of civilian deaths, and how they're trying to make their way out of Afghanistan.
And then, I'm sorry, because I tried to ask you before, and then I interrupted you and me, or maybe it was the commercial's fault or something, but about his capture in Pakistan, and then what happened to him after that, say, between there and Guantanamo.
Yes, well, he was, you know, after he was captured in Pakistan, he was in a... and by the way, his last diary entry is 8 days before he's captured, and he writes, nothing new. That's it. But he was captured on March 28th. There. I'm sorry?
Almost like, hey, watch this, you know, kind of just tempting fate.
Exactly, and you know, he's captured on March 28th, and, you know, he's shot three times, he's near death, a surgeon from Johns Hopkins is flown in to keep him alive, and he's whisked away to a CIA black site, believed to be in Thailand first. And not long after he's brought to the black site, you know, they have his diaries translated, and they build a psychological assessment on him, and they exploit his fears, and they subject him to, you know, to all these torture techniques.
Oh yeah,
and,
like what?
And then he arrives in Guantanamo.
Wait,
finally.
What kind of torture techniques did they subject him to? Other than that, we talked about the drowning there.
Waterboarding, you know, wall slamming. You know, he was hung in stress positions. You know, they proposed putting him in a coffin-like box. One of the proposed techniques, Scott, was placing him in a box with an insect, because he had they said he had a fear of bugs. Well, they discovered his fear of bugs from his diary, because he writes about it. And so, see, that's part of that, you know, the exploitation, that they knew what his fears were. You know, they went through this very carefully, and so that's, one of the proposed techniques.
Is it Jane Mayer's book that says that the reason that really the CIA got him from the FBI was because he really had told them most of what they wanted to know, or was in the process, but the CIA wanted more, and they just thought if they could torture it out of him, he could come up with more, but he didn't really have what they were looking for, and so it was in their frustration, really, that they resorted to that. Or maybe before it got to the point of frustration, I guess. Dick Cheney was in a hurry.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, I think that, you know, part of this is that we still don't know exactly what they were doing. I believe, I didn't report this, but I believe that they were, you know, this was their grand experiment. And I mean the experiment. that, you know, the if they were looking through the diary, Scott, you know, sure, they would have known that there was a level of importance there, but they also would have known that, you know, he wasn't this you know, number three in Al-Qaeda. And you already have the sort of disagreement between his level of importance between, you know, the FBI and the CIA. But, you know, using having this, you know, these diaries to sort of exploit his fears and test out these methods that eventually were tweaked, were first used on him and then tweaked in a way to sort of almost perfect them later on other, you know, prisoners. To me, that's, you know, the whole sort of like, oh, we need to get more intel. I think that's, you know, that's just a cover story.
Yeah, well, it was the same kind of thing with Kutani there at Guantanamo Bay, whereas, well, let's put this guy through the paces and see which combination of these
exactly.
may or may not add up to lowercase a abuse or whatever
right.
technical term that they were trying to stay just within.
Experiment. Yes, I think that's exactly it. And I mean, yeah. you know, we see that to some extent with... you know, again, how this was all sort of, you know, perfected later on when the torture memo was certainly, you know, changed a bit with, you know, instead of, I'm just sort of throwing this out there, instead of pouring, you know, 12 pours, they would do 14, and they based that off of the way Zubeda responded. So, mm-hmm. But look, here we are 12 years after 9/11, and we're still learning about, you know, what was happening, and this is a person whose voice we have never, ever heard from. We've never heard his voice. So the fact that we have this opportunity now, you know, to hear his voice directly, and, you know, people take the time to actually read the source documents, you know, I think that it's, you know, it's just an important part of history, and, you know, people will draw their own conclusions about, you know, what they feel and what they think, but I think it sort of underscores how, you know, the narrative that the U.S. put out is not exactly the right narrative.
Right. And now, you know, I'd hate to leave people with the false impression that Guantanamo is full of a bunch of guys who even had ever met Bin Laden or heard of him necessarily, which most of those people, even still most of them, have nothing to do with, you know, the people who were formerly held by the CIA at their secret prisons and now serve as sort of the window dressing on what is really a warehouse for people who have already been cleared for release. And what's funny to me is, especially the way you put it about how many years ago this was now, that we're still going on with even the Democrats, as Obama put it, that, you know, some of these people, if they're acquitted, we'll still hold them. And some of them, we won't even give them military trials on this made-up, almost ad hoc basis of Military Commission Act courts. Because, you know, maybe we don't have anything against them, and so we don't want to risk that they'll be acquitted, and then that we'll have to hold them indefinitely anyway, and so we'll just not even give them trials at all. And it seems like, you know, hey, this is America, where it's pretty easy that, I mean, it's not like you're going to get a fair trial anyway, but it seems like you could just indict these guys on some charges and convict them, or let them go, because that's just the way we do these things. And none of this implies any mercy for this guy, necessarily. If the government has the evidence that says he's the number three guy in Al-Qaeda somewhere other than these diaries, and let's see it. But that's what trials are for.
Exactly.
But the fact that you would just sit here and tell me, and I know that you mean it, and I know that you're probably right, that no, this guy will die of old age at the lawless American black hole prison in communist Cuba is just amazing. Like, how could that possibly be? He's still only like 40-something, this guy, right?
Yeah, no, he is, but, you know.
I mean, no, we gotta knock this off. It's crazy. Indict him. How hard could it possibly be to convict this guy in federal court when they can convict anyone of anything in federal court? Accuse him of mail fraud or something and just tax
well,
evasion.
Mail fraud would probably be easier, but Scott, you know, keep in mind that the National Defense Authorization Act, you know, for 2014 is coming up for, you know, debate again. And there are numerous provisions in there with regard to Guantanamo, and you know, one of the most important ones is that the Senate, or rather this legislation, is directing, you know, the Department of Defense and the State Department, they want to be sure that Yemen is creating its own Guantanamo for any sort of transfer of prisoners. So they want full reports on what Yemen is doing to detain, prosecute, and even rehabilitate, you know, Yemeni prisoners. So, you know, we're looking to sort of continue the cycle, even with the as we transfer them. So, I mean, this is we've been going through this every year when this legislation is renewed, and you know, we hear the same thing from Obama. My hands are tied. So, you know, here we are, probably, you know, hear that same narrative all over again. So on paper, or rather what, you know, what you're saying is true. How hard can it be? But nobody seems to be willing to sort of, you know, step up and try and do that.
Yep. All right. Well, we're already over time. We got to leave it here and cut it off and all that. But thanks very much for your time. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
All right, everybody. Check out this great journalism at america.aljazeera.com. One, exclusive, Abu Zubaydah's journey from student to Mujahideen. And then two, Zubaydah Diaries shed new light on Twin Towers and links to bin Laden. And then along with that is the secret diary of Abu Zubaydah. So far, they've only published, I believe, the first volume, but the rest are coming up. So check out this awesome scoop at america.aljazeera.com, the great Jason Leopold. And thanks for listening.